Philosophy 10, April 14th, 1954.
When we want to take the step from the idea to the science, we have to get organized. We have to get an institution. If you want to make theology into the new science, as Abelard and Anselm of Canterbury try to make it, it is impossible to carry it on by personal sacrifice, so to speak, all the time. So they have to get organized. And I told you beforehand that the result of their teaching was the universities of the Middle Ages. And now we shall observe the founding of the three great universities of the Middle Ages for theology, for law, and for medicine. And he shall learn what a university is, which you do not know. There is at this moment no university in the United States, in the sense in which universities were created. There are 5 and 10 stores of science, there are Gimbels and Macy's, but there are no universities. And you ought to know this. There are, as we should say, the academies, which is something very different. That is, there are research theaters in this country. But there are no universities. Because the principle of a university was stated by Anselm and Abelard long before there were universities, by their saying that in any one moment the human mind was in process of going excessively beyond the mind so far established. You remember the story of progress in theology, that a new consciousness of any one new sinner demanded a new, greater, larger conception of the divine. That we had to exceed our preconceptions. That no system of theology, therefore, could last. It had always to be improved upon. The second thing Abelard discovered was that there were contradictions in the tradition of the church. You remember the last thing we said before the vacations was that he wrote a book on yes and no, and said, on the one hand side, the fathers of the church have said one thing, on the other, they have said the opposite. What is true between the two? By logical reason, we must now deduce how to reconcile these contradictions. The university, gentlemen, is the application of these two principles of a constant excess over the knowledge as it exists. Then it isn't good enough what we know. We must know better. And the university is then based on a reversal of the ordinary process of thinking. You think, and then you try to improve on your thinking. That's your self-education. But gentlemen, a science can only live if that which is known is replaced by something yet unknown. The university is based then on this principle of learned ignorance. Doctor Ignorantia is a famous term through the whole Middle Ages of the university principle. You are just ignorant. There's no merit in this. And you try to become learned. You see? That is the way of all flesh. But the way of the spirit is the opposite. The way of the spirit, gentlemen, is to be equipped with all the learning Dartmouth College can offer you. And if you want to go into research, in physics, for example, to be able to question everything you have learned and lay new foundations for the next generation. That is, to jump down from the peak of knowledge to the abyss of ignorance. Voluntary ignorance is the secret of research. Voluntary ignorance. And unlike ignorance, an ignorance which makes you suspect, you see, that you are not then a regular fellow. You don't know the risks of research. The risk of research is that you risk your reputation if you say something that is not in tune with the accepted principles of knowledge. When the famous Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who at that time, as you know, was in teaching at Dartmouth College, had the bright idea that the apple fever was infectious, which nobody knew 100 years ago, he was laughed at and ridiculed. And so he had his neck out and he risked his reputation, because according to the scientific standards of his time, this was ridiculous. That's a typical story of how the herbal receiver needed courage to be found for what it was. The ordinary, soft-spoken Mr. Stevens, Secretary of War, would never have said so, you see, because it wasn't done. The people whom you adore, who are received into all secret and open society, the joiners, the people who are appointed to all the embassies in this country, you see, all our diplomatic representatives, as they are beyond the Korea, diplomats, Mrs. Meister, as you know, called me madam. This is your idea of humanity, by and large, for public life. The research is the opposite. It's a man who is not polite, who is tough and gruesome and quarrelsome, is probably the man who has a real idea. You don't believe it. You hate it. That's why no great scientific progress has ever been made in the United States so far. It's all bought from abroad. Important. You can't make it because you want the people to agree with you, and you want to agree with the people. And if you want to do this, you cannot have progress. So the Dr. Ignorance allows the fighter gentleman, the knight, to turn from the weapons of battle to the weapons of the spirit. And the great symbol is the sword of the faith of St. Paul, which at that time in the 12th century became the great symbol of the new scientific progress. The sword of the faith. Of faith, the knighthood of the doctors. In the Middle Ages, gentlemen, when a man became a doctor at commencement, he had to take an oath on the open Bible, for example, or the open law book, or the open medicine book, whatever his doctorate would be, and he had to say that he would read it. Then the book had to be closed, and he had to say that he would ponder over it and doubt it. And then he was given a sword and a knighthood of the doctorate, that he would then would swing the truth, the sword of truth. There was a total imitation of knighthood for the first form of university life in medieval Europe, because it was felt that this was a crusade, that this was a sublimation, or how would you say, transfiguration of a mental fight, you see. And when you read in the famous poem by Blake, "I shall not cease from mental fight," do you remember? Who knows it? "I shall not cease from mental fight." Well, that's the second national anthem of England. Never heard of it. They sing it now for the last 30 years there as a national anthem. Don't you know this? "Jerusalem" by Blake? Then who does not know? Who does know this? Did you not amaze? What? How does it begin? Have you never heard of the satanic mills? I thought this could take it for granted. Well, will you kindly bring this poem to class next time? It's a great poem, gentlemen, and as I said, every English Jewish school child knows it by heart. So you better get acquainted with it. And there is this word which he could pick up, the quite unusual phrase, "I shall not cease from mental fight." And that's taken from the university of the first century. Mental fight was unknown before. There were fights of religion, of faith,
But there was no mental fight. That is, no fight in the classroom. The schools were very, you see, tepid affairs, lukewarm. As your behavior here, you are not in a mental fight. You are in a coma. The second principle, this is the learned ignorance. The jumping down, leaping down into the abyss of a new ignorance in order to get higher the second time, the next time. The dismissal of the prejudices, you see, of the mind. In organized science, that is the way of progress. Very different one. You think always of evolution, gentlemen. That doesn't exist. Nobody has ever seen evolution, except decay. Evolution is the same as decay. If you have anything long enough, it decays. That's evolution. Don't be betrayed. Evolution always means degeneration. You have a piece of brass long enough and that's patina. It evolves as patina. And if you have a city government and at the end, it's rotten. That's evolution. And then you have to start a revolution to build it up again. That's not ever done by evolution, any reform. Never. But you have this wonderful Darwinian idea spread by the robber barons in the 70s of the last century in this country, that everything went by evolution so that they could explain their tremendous gains to the people. They had to be justified, the injustices that happened. Gentlemen, there is no evolution in the human universe. There is progress, and progress is done at the risk of abandonment. Abandon the old self-securities. You cannot have progress without sacrificing safety. You cannot. We wouldn't fly if we had just gone straight safe to this day, obviously. Somebody had to try to get up in the air, and many lost their lives in the process. In a similar way, only by jumping downward, so to speak, into ignorance, all research jeopardizes the knowledge so far attained by questioning it. The second principle is the principle of a higher logic. The Middle Ages gentlemen are far better logicians than people today who boast that they are. The poorer forces in logic, I think, fall very short of their performance because they knew that there is not just the logic of the syllogism that child's play. The multiplication table of logic, gentlemen, who cares what how 5 times 5, I mean, for this you can have a machine. But higher mathematics, calculus, that's something. Now, in a similar way, logic on the higher plane of the Middle Ages and their universities was paradoxical. A paradox means that Socrates is a man, all men are mortals, and Socrates must die. Socrates is a spirit, spirits are immortal, and Socrates cannot die. So this, so to speak, on this level, it's an arbitrary example, the Middle Ages would begin to think. They wouldn't think anything of such a cheap statement that all men are mortals, Socrates is a mortal, therefore Socrates must die. Well, that's taken for granted. That's for children, you see. But how about the fact that he isn't dead? That he is still alive, and he is dead all at the same time. The thing becomes interesting, because obviously you have now to distinguish, and you have to be very sure that you understand, you see, in how far he is dead and how far he is not dead. If you have contradictory statements, gentlemen, there the university has its meat, has its center of attention. And in America, gentlemen, where you use all this common sense, there is no science, no higher logic, because you actually think that you can find the truth by syllogism. But gentlemen, obviously, you are half dead and half alive. If I say that you are alive and have great vitality, I'm flattering you. If I say that you are sound asleep, I'm scolding you. But obviously, you are half asleep and half alive. That will amount probably to the truth. We all are, by the way. Thought made her sleepy.
He doesn't make him do it because very intelligent.
That is the paradox, gentlemen. Will you take this down? The paradox is the basis of university logic. We do not worry about the first class grammar school logic. That's understood. That's just an explanation of what we say, actually. But the explanation of the fact that we have to make contradictory statements, that's important. I mean, if I say Socrates is a mortal, I really only unfold what I have said in the first place, that he is one of the mortal men. This syllogism doesn't amount to any discovery, it's just a restatement of my terms, a defining of my terms, that's what you learn. But gentlemen, the thing only becomes important if anything is at the same time one thing and the other. That's called dialectics,
isn't it?
In Marxism. And the medieval people were great dialecticians. They knew that from the point of view of Americans, America is free and Europe is not free. And from the point of Russia, as you know, they think our freedom is anarchy. If you talk to a Russian about American freedom, he says, yes, it is terrible how the women run around there. That's what they think is our freedom. The obscenity of Hollywood. That's freedom. They think that is freedom. That's dialectics, you see. Our freedom and their freedom are completely contradictory. That both are right. I mean, from their point of view, our freedom is terrible. And from our point of view, their tyranny is terrible. And that's dialectics. That is, there are two truths, and they have to cohabit. Very difficult. But life only is there where there is such higher insight into the contradictions of life. We love and we hate. Now, the sweet and light school says, oh, you always must love, you see. And the belligerent McCarthy say, we always must hate. Well, obviously, both are not interesting, you see. The gist of the matter is that you must hate evil and the devil, and you must love your neighbor and God as you see. And now you do this, and then you begin to see how difficult it is. I was told an important story which may illustrate this, gentlemen, and I think it's, although it seems to be a side issue, I think it is more practical for your understanding. This country, you see, has no university tradition on political, on war and peace. And pacifism has ruined the imagination of most of you to such an extent that you do not carry the virtues of peace into the war. When a man is a soldier in this country, even his chaplain has not the courage or not the imagination to teach him gallantry against the enemy. I had two friends who were chaplains on Saipan. Did I tell you the story already? Really? And they saw two naked Japanese lying there, corpses, in the field. They stared at them, and they went home. And I said to them, and they told me the story, and you didn't bury them. No, we didn't. They were Japanese after all. These people call themselves chaplains. But you don't even understand my disgust with these people. What's the reason for this untold barbarism? You don't even understand that it's barbaric, that they, what they did. They were chaplains. The first thing a man has to do is to bury the dead. But you have a book, The Naked and the Dead. Who has read it? Well, of course, it's so obscene. And, and in this book it is said that an innocent prisoner is shot. And the whole country has not accused this man of high treason because he has insulted the American army. Why? Because it is a true story. This could never have happened in another army. This country is so pacifist that when it comes to war, all the governesses and all the nice school teachers and all the women's clubs and all the chaplains and all the clergymen and all the teachers stand by and say, well, it doesn't matter. War is so bad, you can't help it anyway. And they do not bring the paradox of human existence into the war, that you have to be a gallant soldier, that you have to be a compassionate soldier, and that you are not allowed to shoot a prisoner. Or to rape a girl, as a 13-year-old girl in Holland, as our grandmother told me the other day, was raped by an American soldier. An allied country. An allied country. And a 13-year-old girl raped by an American soldier has never happened in any other army. Why? Because this man had been told war is forbidden. War, you should not go to war. Now he goes to war. He breaks the taboo. So he says it doesn't matter. I'm in hell anyway. War is hell. I've discussed this with friends, and they say war is hell anyway. So what does it matter? What does it mean, gentlemen? That you want to have a school class logic. Here is war, that's hell. Here is peace, that's heaven. So in peacetime we behave, in war we don't behave. Gentlemen, the higher logic of real grown-up people consists in your being able to be the civilian while you are in uniform and to be the soldier while you are in civilian clothes. There only life begins. And you are so utterly schizophrenic that you cannot have any paradoxical logic. You deny it. You say it's impossible. You have been told that the only thing that exists is the multiplication table and the syllogism. Gentlemen, that's for children. Grown-up people know that they love and they hate. They know that there are saints and sinners. The same person. There are no saints here and sinners there. That's the whole gospel. That's the gospel of the remission of sins. That we all are sinners and saints in one person. As long as you do not understand this, you cannot live. Not really live. You are the slaves of the situation. Here you are in civilian clothes and you are sheep. And then you are in uniform, then you are wolves. Is that a decision? Is that an order? Is that a thinking or a reputation of the United States of America? You have to be both, sheep and wolf. Because we are tigers and lions and doves and parrots and everything. We are everything. This is our paradox. And that's why this army has lost sight of this, of its true mission to spread the good name of the civilian America while wearing the uniform. There's nothing unnatural about this. It's natural. Man is always more than one thing. He's always two at least. Gentlemen, this is Abelard's discovery, that the same thing may be true and not true at the same time. Therefore, the great invention of the university captivates and eternalizes, perpetuates this great discovery, which shows you that the Middle Ages were far in advance mentally from our own times. They were far ahead of you and me in their daily practice of living the paradox, of forgiving the enemy and fighting him at the same time, as occasion arises. You can't do this. You are so primitive. A university, gentlemen, takes this down in writing. A university is a place where, at the same time, opposite truths are taught on the same subject. A university is an institution of learning where at the same time, on the same topic, opposite opinions are taught to the same student. So from the very first day, a student of a university is told that two honorable people may very well have to tell opposite opinions on the same thing. And if you have 50 opinions on the same subject, you don't have a university. They have to be contradictory. That is, they have to face each other. The man who says, this is so, the Pope should be superior to the Emperor, for example, in the Middle Ages, would have to be confronted by another teacher who says the Emperor must be beyond the Pope. If you have just an opinion who says any 50 opinions are no opinions. We have universities, as I said, they are like 5 and 10 stores. You can have everything, and that's why you can have nothing. The truth can only be had in dialectics, one or the other. One or the other. It's like treading water in ordination. In the flood, in the sea of troubles in which we live, you have to emphasize at one time the one and at other times the other truth in living by living people. And a professor at a university, gentlemen, is a man engaged in the representation of one of two opposite opinions. That's why we always have schools of thought. And I try to bring this out in my ninth commandment teacher, that all teachers need opposition, that Plato needs Aristotle, that you must not enslave the human mind ever as a teacher by ignoring the fact that somebody else must also hold the opposite view. That's higher logic. It's worth your meditation. And in war and peace, today your task, gentlemen. We must refound American mental life around a real philosophy or theology or religion or however you call it, doctrine of war and peace. Or we are lost with the hydrogen bomb. If you do not understand that it is not, the human mind is always absolute. Reality is never absolute. Our mind is not able to ever to think out the whole universe. So we need opposition. We need opponents. In England, they pay the leader of the opposition for this reason, because the country would go to pieces without an opposition. And this is only the application of the medieval university principle. It was unknown in antiquity. There were no parties. Not recognized. They turned out as bad, you see. Was faction. We know that it is the heart of life, that our minds are so tyrannical, so absolutist, that the mind must be opposed by mind. There's no merit to have unanimity, gentlemen, in mental cases. The hearts must be united and the minds must oppose each other. You have the opposite idea. You want others to agree with the other fellow. You have to disagree with the other fellow if you want to live with him. Don't you see this? Your heart must be united, but not your mind. Otherwise, you two together will become the worst tyrants of the world, if you are always in agreement. Because it will become one prejudice, one big prejudice, your mind. The minds must be in disagreement. And as soon as you have no opposition, gentlemen, you have no mental life. I shall not cease from mental fight, as Blake says, William Blake, means that the university embodies the discovery of the Christian era, gentlemen. The last formula today is, as long as human souls remain united, it is vital that the minds shall disagree, should disagree. This is important, gentlemen, because we discover here the distinction between soul and mind. The soul, who is taking philosophy 9? You remember we made this point there, that soul and mind are totally different. Here you discover the practical application. In all the sciences, you need opponents. You need dialectics. You see one person saying this illness comes from this reason and the other saying the very opposite. And they must not stone each other, but they must invite opposition in the mind. As long as their souls remain united, you see. The souls one. The heart one. The hearts of men must remain one. The minds must split. It's the opposite from what you do. Okay. Who has not in his paper on